This is John K. Wilson and Sholly Pittman with your local news coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in snowy, snowy downtown Madison. Happy spring election.
Happy spring election. Former President Donald Trump used a campaign rally in Green Bay today to paint a grim picture of immigration in the United States and repeated his false claims that he won Wisconsin in the 2020 presidential election. During a speech to a crowd of supporters, Trump slammed the Biden administration's border policies and claimed that migrants are turning the U.S. into a, quote, third-world country. Trump also doubled down on fabricated claims that he defeated President Joe Biden in Wisconsin in 2020. Biden won the state by just over 20,000 votes. Multiple recounts and court rulings have confirmed those results. The Green Bay event was the presumptive Republican nominee's first visit to the battleground Wisconsin state in 2024. Our state is once again expected to be among the most tightly contested in the country this November.
Meanwhile, President Joe Biden is slated to visit Madison next week. The White House announced this morning that Biden will hold a campaign event Monday, where he plans to discuss lowering costs of living. Location and other specifics haven't yet been released, according to Wisconsin Public Radio. It will be the president's third trip to Wisconsin already this year and his 10th since taking office as president. Most recently, Biden visited Milwaukee last month to announce a transportation funding plan. Vice President Kamala Harris, First Lady Jill Biden, and other campaign backers have also made several recent stops in Wisconsin.
Governor Tony Evers vetoed a bill today that would have put strict new limits on transgender student athletes in Wisconsin schools. That's reporting from the Wisconsin State Journal. The Republican-backed legislation sought to bar trans students from playing on high school sports teams that match their gender identities. It passed the state Senate and Assembly along party lines, but Republicans don't have enough votes to override the governor's veto. In a veto message, Evers said that proposals like this one, quote, harm LGBTQ Wisconsinites and kids' mental health, and emboldens anti-LGBTQ harassment, bullying, and violence, unquote. At least 20 other states have successfully enacted similar bans on trans athletes, but the Biden administration is planning a federal policy that would reverse such policies.
UW-Madison and UW-System employees will soon be offered paid parental leave. Regents for the Universities of Wisconsin are set to sign off on the new benefits during a meeting Thursday, the Capital Times reports. Full-time faculty and staff across the system will be able to take 6 weeks of paid leave after the birth or adoption of a child. Student teaching, research, and project assistants at UW-Madison will also be eligible, and part-time employees will receive a prorated amount of leave time. Currently, parents only have the option to use sick time, vacation, or unpaid time off. The new policy is set to go into effect on July 1st.
And in other UW system news, communities that lose a university branch campus will be eligible to get up to $2 million in state money for redevelopment. Governor Tony Evers signed the Republican-authored plan into law this week, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and a total pot of $20 million will be available for municipalities where a two-year campus shuts down. Richland Center, Washington County, Fond du Lac, and Marinette are at the top of the list. They each have a UW campus that is either already closed or will close by the end of this school year. Communities have to spend the money on economic development projects, but options range from job training programs to demolition or redevelopment of campus buildings.
A winter storm warning is in effect for Dane County tonight. Madison is expected to see 2 to 5 inches of wet snow through about midnight. The winter storm warning is in effect until 7 a.m. tomorrow, with a winter weather advisory after that. Road conditions will be sloppy, and weather officials are cautioning commuters to take extra care this evening. Dane County emergency officials are urging people to stay at home after their evening commute. The Dane County Sheriff's Office and the 911 Center report a number of traffic incidents related to the heavy snow and slick roads. And the Dane County Highway Department has been out since before the snow fell this afternoon, but says that heavy travel has made snow removal and cleanup challenging. More snow or rain is possible tomorrow morning.
And despite the messy weather, you could still vote. Wisconsin polling places are open tonight until 8 p.m. And if you're in line by then, 8 p.m., stay in line. You can still vote. The April election ballot includes Wisconsin's presidential preference primary, as well as two statewide referendums related to election administration. Locally, 10 Dane County Board Supervisor seats are being contested, and other uncontested races like judge and Madison School Board member are also on the ballot. For a full breakdown of ballot measures and local candidate profiles, hey, you can find WORT's election guide online at wortfm.org. That's wortfm.org. And the Madison Clerk's Office reports this evening that turnout as of 4 p.m. As a percentage of pre-registered voters was at about 17%, with 32,222 ballots counted as of 4 p.m. And those were the headlines. Now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Governor Tony Evers submitted a brief of the state Supreme Court, brief to the state Supreme Court yesterday as part of the case to reconsider whether ballot drop boxes are legal. WORT News producer Faye Parks has that update.
It's election day, and the polls are open until 8 p.m. In Wisconsin, all absentee ballots need to be returned by election day. So if you have an absentee ballot but haven't sent it back, you can return it to your polling place by 8 p.m. for your vote to be counted. More than 19,000 absentee ballots had already been issued to Madison voters as of last Wednesday, a combination of in-person early voting and ballots by mail. And Wisconsin could be poised to resurface another way to return ballots, one that emerged in the pandemic, absentee ballot drop boxes. More than 570 drop boxes were in use across Wisconsin as of spring 2021. 14 of those drop boxes were in Madison. But since 2022, those drop boxes have laid dormant in cities across the state after the Wisconsin Supreme Court banned them in a case brought by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative legal firm. That's when a majority of the court decided that absentee ballots must be delivered in person at a clerk's office. In a sweeping opinion of election rules, the state's highest court also found that voters had to return their own ballots instead of relying on someone else to hand it in. Since then, voting rights advocates have argued against the decision, saying that removing an option to hand in ballots makes voting more difficult. Today, Governor Tony Evers announced he is urging the state Supreme Court to reverse their decision and bring back drop boxes as a tool for local clerks to use as a safe and secure voting option. He submitted a brief yesterday asking to be part of the case, brought by Priorities USA, a Democratic super PAC, and originally filed in the Dane County Circuit Court last September. It's now before the state Supreme Court, which last month agreed to review their 2022 decision. The court is set to hear oral arguments next month. This time, the liberal-leaning state court could decide to reverse course from their decision 2 years ago, when the balance of power on the court leaned conservative. Madison's 14 absentee ballot drop boxes, located outside fire stations throughout the city, are still up. Today, they're covered in art and snow and lying dormant, but they could be back in use by the time the presidential election rolls around in November. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
Dual-eligible special needs plans, pronounced DSNPs, provide both Medicare and Medicaid coverage. Experts say they meet the unique needs of those who can sign up for the coverage, but many people aren't aware they're eligible. Mike Moen of the Wisconsin News Connection has this story.
Medicare and Medicaid are key sources of health coverage for many Americans, but some people qualify for assistance under both programs. With lagging enrollment for the unique plans, outreach efforts are underway. According to KFF Health News, only about 3 in 10 people who qualify for dual-eligible special needs plans were enrolled in 2021. Experts say the option is designed for people who need additional help because of disabilities, certain health conditions, or their age. Dr. Gina Williams with United Healthcare says these plans try to take a dynamic approach to serving those eligible.
Everything from managing your wellness to managing your behavioral health needs, and then everyday needs. So it's kind of a more comprehensive package for people who need a little bit more support.
Those everyday needs she mentioned include meal benefits and bathroom safety devices. The National Council on Aging says DSNPs aim to provide a more streamlined coordination of care because there's assistance in arranging the services. Wisconsin's enrollment numbers are similar to the national rate, coming in at 28%. Christine Huberty with the Greater Wisconsin Agency on Aging Resources says a tricky component of these plans is navigating provider network restrictions. A rural resident might have to travel farther to see a doctor covered under the plan, and she says that warrants careful research when enrolling.
I would say first and foremost, look at the provider network restrictions and look at what's available in your area.
Meanwhile, Williams says the push to get more eligible people to sign up coincides with more awareness about preventative care in a post-pandemic world.
Everybody's kind of going into a phase where they're not only thinking about acute illness, but they're thinking about overall care. Like, what was the impact of the pandemic from a psychological standpoint? Do you need more support? And then do you also need more coordination of benefits?
This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Over the last month, the opinion section in the Cap Times has been flooded with debate over Madison's housing crisis, namely the city's attempt to address it through proactive rezoning and more affordable development. The Marquette neighborhood is located on Madison's Near East Side, and Eric Hamilton is the vice president of the Neighborhood Association. He shared his perspective on the housing debate with WORT News producer Faye Parks earlier today.
Lately, the opinion section of Madison's progressive newspaper, the Capital Times, has been grappling with a Madison on the precipice of change that's largely been driven by the newspaper's publisher, Paul Fanlon. Last month, in an opinion piece, Fanlon took issue with the draft West Area Plan. That plan is an attempt from city planners to accommodate the more than 110,000 new residents expected to arrive in the city by 2050. Fanlon argues, in part, that city admin, in their attempt to make room for new residents, is leaving established homeowners out of the conversation, and it's provoked a flood of responses and online debate. In a new op-ed published yesterday, Fanlon references a supportive email he received from Madison historian David Mollenhoff. Mollenhoff initially published his book, Madison, A History of the Formative Years, in 1982, and the account, which outlines Madison's evolution since 1876, was republished in 2003. In his email to Fanlon, Mollenhoff argues that the city was better off when neighborhood associations had more say. He points to his own neighborhood, Marquette, as evidence, saying that the area flourished under former Mayor Paul Soglin's tenure. He writes, quote, "It was a time when citizens had at least as much power as the planners," unquote. Eric Hamilton is the current vice president of the Marquette Neighborhood Association. He's on the line now to tell us what planning and redevelopment looks like in their neck of the woods. Thank you for joining me, Eric.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
How would you say neighborhood associations' power has shifted since Mayor Rhodes Conway was first elected?
I think that there maybe has been a slight power shift in that the city is looking to expand its listening process beyond only neighborhood associations. For example, not every neighborhood in Madison has a neighborhood association, and many of those neighborhood associations aren't particularly active with city processes. So my understanding is the changes reflect a desire to make sure that there are multiple ways for citizens to have their voices heard, in addition to listening to neighborhood associations, but having other means as well. We think it's extremely important that we have a seat at the table to discuss with the city how we want to see our neighborhood develop. We know we are not the only seat that should be at the table. It should include other groups as well, including people who may, for whatever reason, not be members of the Marquette Neighborhood Association. We have a lot of neighbors who aren't directly involved. They still deserve a voice as well.
So can you walk us through what kind of planning power neighborhood associations typically have in Madison right now?
Right now, most of our power comes from the ability to influence when a developer needs some sort of special permission for their project. So there are two kinds of projects, as I understand it. One would be called by right, that essentially, as long as they check off the list of requirements from the city, they get to do it. The second, and by far the most common, at least in my experience in the Marquette neighborhood, would involve some kind of conditional use. They need some special permission to build more stories than are typically allowed, or something like that. And when that is necessary, they have to go through a number of additional steps with the city, and they can choose, and usually do choose, to come to a neighborhood association like the Marquette Neighborhood Association to ask for feedback and ultimately support before groups like the Plan Commission for the city. So when we have a chance to review their plans, we can provide feedback, say what we do like or what we don't like or what we might like to change, and ultimately typically come to the level of providing a letter of support, perhaps with one or more of these conditions that we've agreed to with the developer, saying, please approve this project as we understand it. We would like to see it in our neighborhood. And then that can provide some influence to the Plan Commission and ultimately the Common Council, essentially letting the developer say, we have the approval of the neighborhood.
Are there any obstacles that the Marquette neighborhood faces when it comes to developing affordable housing?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've been very welcoming of market rate housing. We think that it's valuable to have housing of pretty much every possible kind in the neighborhood to welcome new people into the neighborhood. But we are always looking for two additional types of housing that come up to us much less frequently. One is owner-occupied housing, which would really be condos at this point, and the other is affordable housing or income-restricted housing. We don't see a lot of that proposed. We have discussed this in great depth with developers who specialize in affordable housing. The ultimate reason is it requires some kind of subsidy, and not every developer is interested in pursuing that or really specialized in it because it requires a number of rules and regulations on their behalf. But we would love to see additional affordable housing, and we'll continue to work with the city to do what we can to incentivize that in our neighborhood because it's really essential.
So in Paul Fanlon's recent opinion piece in the Cap Times, he referenced an email from a historian, David Mollenhoff, who wrote that while Paul Soglin was mayor, Marquette citizens developed their own master plan that actually reduced density in an effort to bring in more families. So with that in mind, do you believe that this would be an effective way to sort of diversify and fix up your neighborhood?
No, I don't think that we would support reducing density. The current Marquette Neighborhood Association, I think, would support additional density. This is because we all feel extremely lucky to live in what we think is one of the best neighborhoods in the state, one of the most walkable neighborhoods in the state, and a very friendly neighborhood. And we would like to welcome more people to join us here in the Marquette neighborhood. With all of the parcels already spoken for, the only way to do that is with increased density.
And so looking ahead, what kind of Marquette neighborhood would you like to see in the future? And what kind of Madison would you like to see?
I would love to see a Marquette neighborhood that can welcome all the people who want to live in the Marquette neighborhood. Maybe not everybody does. Maybe they just want to come shop and dine on Willie Street, and that's totally fine. But if you want to join us here in the Marquette neighborhood, I think you should be able to, and you should be able to afford to. And I think one way that we can get at that is by adding some density in order to reduce the rising rent pressure that we see all across the city and to simply have the physical space to welcome people, because it's the people that make the Marquette neighborhood as wonderful as it is. You know, I think that that can extend hopefully to the city as a whole. That column that you referenced was talking about how in 2013, they thought we would have to accommodate 70,000 new citizens by 2040. I looked it up. We are on pace to way overshoot that. The current expectation is we will now need to welcome 115,000 new people by 2050. And if I had a guess, I'd say we'll probably overshoot that too. These folks need a place to live. I think we should welcome them, including in the central city, where welcoming them means building more densely. And I think that can achieve a number of our goals, not only being a welcoming city, but also improving things like environmental sustainability. Because if you're in a walkable, transit-oriented neighborhood, you don't have to drive as much, which contributes to pollution and, you know, carbon emissions. So I hope that that's, you know, a vision that we can work together to achieve, and doing so also with the opportunity to provide people with affordable places that they can live.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Eric.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That was Eric Hamilton, Vice President of the Marquette Neighborhood Association.
The time is now exactly 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, John Wilson, here with my co-host, Charlie Pittman. Thanks for joining us. This evening, the Wisconsin Historical Society is launching a three-week event series titled Waging Peace in Vietnam, U.S. Soldiers and Veterans Who Opposed the War. Susan Schnall was active in the GI anti-war movement and is the current president of Veterans for Peace. She'll be speaking as part of tonight's opening event titled Soldiers in Revolt at the Wisconsin Historical Society Auditorium. Schnall appeared on this Sunday's Her Turn, WORT's feminist news show, to discuss her anti-war activism with Joanne Powers.
Waging Peace in Vietnam is a project, a photo exhibit, and a narrative that has been going around the country to various colleges and universities, as well as Ho Chi Minh City to the War Remnants Museum, to talk about the GI and veteran anti-war movement that was so active in the 1960s as a protest and as an expression of individual members of the armed forces of disagreement with the current government about the waging war in Vietnam and Southeast Asia. It was an opportunity and a really important voice that we felt the American people had to hear, and that was of ordinary soldiers who said, our government that is waging this war in Southeast Asia is wrong. The troops need to be pulled out, and we need to come to a peace agreement.
And that is the subject of the Soldiers in Revolt event that you're doing on Tuesday.
There are a number of us who will be speaking about our experiences and our activities against the United States military and the government's actions 8,000 miles from the United States.
What is your personal experience with the war and with turning against it?
I was a nurse. I joined the United States Navy to take care of those who were wounded in war and make them what I thought would be whole again, both physically and emotionally, to be able to go back to their communities and their families and live the rest of their lives in peace. And I soon learned that, in fact, that was not my role, that as a nurse in the United States Navy, yes, my role was to get them well again so they could go back into battle and they could fight again and they could continue this war so many miles away. I knew and I felt when I joined the military that I was against war and against armed fighting. But I also felt again that I would be doing something positive for these primarily young men. And what I found out when I joined the military is that now I would become part of the military machine, that I was part of that instrument that allowed the government to continue the fight so many miles away. And I thought I needed to do something about this. I needed to have my voice heard to be able to say to the American public, I'm against this war, I'm against this fighting. And I felt that as a member of the armed services, I would be heard. I joined in late fall 1968, an organization called GI and Veterans March for Peace. I was working at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital in Oakland, California, where we took care of the active duty GIs who returned from war. And we put flyers together. We put posters up all over the hospital. They were torn down. So our voices certainly were not being heard. And I had heard about the United States military dropping flyers, leaflets on the Vietnamese in South and Central Vietnam that urged them to go to these so-called protective hamlets to avoid being sprayed by Agent Orange dioxin that the United States was using to destroy the crops in Vietnam, to devastate the land, to destroy the woodlands, also to avoid the bombing by the United States. And I thought, well, if the United States could do this, drop flyers on this land so many thousand miles away, why couldn't we who were in the military in the United States drop peace flyers on military installations in the Bay Area? I had a friend who was a pilot, and we loaded up this one engine paper club with thousands and thousands of flyers that were announcing the GI and Veterans March for Peace in the San Francisco Bay Area on October 12th. And we dropped the flyers on October 10th over 5 military installations in the Bay Area. We dropped them on Oak Mill Naval Hospital, on Treasure Island, on Yerba Buena Island, on the Presidio, which was an Army base in San Francisco. And then we flew into Alameda Naval Air Station and dropped the flyers on a U.S. aircraft carrier. And then held a press conference after that where I wore my uniform and said, yes, we are active duty GIs and we are against the United States war on Southeast Asia. And then 2 days later, we had a GI and Veterans March for Peace in San Francisco. And I wore my uniform and spoke out against the war. For that, I faced, it was an Article 15 for disobeying a general naval regulation for wearing my uniform publicly to talk about political issues and for harming the morale of those GIs and active duty who saw the flyers. My defense was, well, if General Westmoreland can go before the United States Congress and request more troops and more armaments for war and for killing and for harming people, then why can't I, as an active duty person in the military, speak against this war and speak for peace? I was tried by general court-martial a couple of months later and found guilty of both charges. The prosecuting attorney wanted 5 years at hard labor for my two terrible, terrible events.
Obviously, this is a huge topic, but if you can just very briefly tell me about the enormous costs of war, both for American soldiers, but also for those in Southeast Asia.
Part of the cost that was so horrendous was that we taught these young people to hate people who look different from them and to use slurs about the Vietnamese people and to look at them as disposable, that they had the right to kill and to destroy this land and this people. We think there's about 3 million Vietnamese who died during the American intervention overseas. We had about 2.5 million American troops on the ground until the United States turned the war into an air war, because they realized that for those who had boots on the ground and learned more and more about the war, they became more anti-war. So the war changed as those involved in the military became more anti-military and anti-war in Vietnam. But Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia suffered millions of lives lost. But in addition, during the war, we dropped so much Agent Orange dioxin and Agent Blue and Agent Purple to destroy the forest land, the mangrove forest, and the food supply, that war on Vietnam continues. There are parts of the land where food no longer grows. We have dropped so much ordnance and bombs and cluster bombs that didn't detonate when they landed on the land and remain on that land, particularly in a province called Quang Tri, that when farmers go to plow the land or children are playing in the land, those explosives go off even today and continue to maim and kill. So the war didn't stop just because there was a treaty signed. The remnants of that war continue. That's what happens in war, that it doesn't just end when the troops leave. Today, we're facing another multiple wars all over the world. Most clearly, I think about Aaron Bushnell, the young 25-year-old airman who immolated himself in front of the Israeli military because he felt he was a part of that war, even though he didn't go overseas, that he enabled the war to continue. It is so important for people to understand that what you do to continue that war, to our executive branch that continues to go around Congress to fund what I would call genocide against the people who live in Gaza, is a continuation of the United States involvement with 850 military bases all over the world. We continue to fund our military. We continue to fund these wars that continue instead of sitting down and negotiating a peace and saying, stop, we're not going to do that. I feel a responsibility to those who continue to get harmed by our government and our military, and that it's time that we all stood up and say, stop this war against people. Be for peace. Be for negotiation. Understand that the only industry that makes a profit out of war is the military-industrial complex, against which President Eisenhower warned us. They are the profit makers. They want these wars to continue. They want to continue making money off this terrible destruction of life on the planet, of all living things.
That was Susan Schnall, president of Veterans for Peace, talking with her turn's Joanne Powers. Schnall is one of several speakers tonight, kicking off the latest series at the Wisconsin Historical Society, Waging Peace in Vietnam, U.S. Soldiers and Veterans Who Opposed the War.
Earlier this year, Governor Evers used federal funds to acquire conservation easements along the Pelican River. At the time, there was some ostensibly local opposition to the land purchase. But a recent investigation from the Wisconsin Examiner has found that a Texas-based anti-conservation group spearheaded much of that pushback. Charles Carlin is the Strategic Initiatives Director of Gathering Waters, a statewide consortium of Wisconsin land trusts. He gave Brian Standing the rundown on yesterday's 8 o'clock Buzz.
Welcome back to the 8 o'clock Buzz, Charles.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. So who is this group, American Stewards of Liberty?
So the American Stewards of Liberty are a Texas-based extremist anti-conservation group. Their shtick is to travel the country and try and get county boards, especially, to pass resolutions opposing conservation efforts. So these are things like resolutions to oppose President Biden's America the Beautiful initiative, which seeks to protect 30% of land and water by 2030. Or they work with county governments to invoke a so-called power of coordination, which is a kind of hocus pocus where counties say that they can just veto the land use decisions of private property owners, states, or the federal government. There's no substance to it, but they make a bunch of money in consulting fees, and they really mislead local government officials as to what their powers are to determine land use decisions.
So the idea of being anti-conservation just seems almost, it seems like a non sequitur in some ways. Are these actually grassroots groups, or is there something behind that that's supporting this sort of operation?
This is not a grassroots effort by any means. The executive director of American Stewards of Liberty is a woman by the name of Margaret Byfield. Her father, a gentleman by the name of Wayne Hagee, was one of the initial progenitors of what we call the Sagebrush Rebellion, which during the Ronald Reagan era was this sort of right-wing backlash against land conservation efforts that really came out of this outrageous sense of entitlement that people think they should be able to use federal lands however they wanted. So Margaret's father, Wayne, he refused to pay grazing fees for 20 years running his cattle on federal land. And they somehow thought that they were entitled to just use federal land as they wanted, as if it was their own. They lost that fight. Ultimately, they had to pay more than $500,000 in grazing fees. But it really kind of sparked this movement where they say that public land should be used for extractive industry. That extraction might be cattle, but more often that's oil and that's gas and that's mining. And we see that a lot of that oil and gas money is what drives American Stewards of Liberty.
Talk about how they got involved in Oneida County. What did that campaign look like, and how many people were taken in by this?
So as the campaign to protect the Pelican River Forest moved forward, and you know, just as a quick reminder, Pelican River Forest it's the largest conservation effort in modern Wisconsin history. So we've got more than 70,000 acres of working forest protected for all of Wisconsin forever now. Our Wisconsin congressperson, Tom Tiffany, really tried to sabotage the project at the last minute. He sought to block the federal funding, and he invited the American Stewards of Liberty to come to Wisconsin and to work with a handful of county board members to try and block that funding at the last minute. Now, to be clear, this wasn't even a majority of county board members. It wasn't an official action by county boards. Really, Tiffany, the American Stewards of Liberty, and a handful of individual county board members sought to intervene and block that federal funding through this bogus idea of coordination. You know, essentially what they say is they do a word search through statutes, and they say, well, the word coordinate appears in the Endangered Species Act, and so therefore, if we're going to conserve land using federal money, we have to seek the permission of local government. And then they change the meaning of that word coordinate. And what coordinate means is that an individual county board member should have a veto authority over a popular conservation effort. So in this case, while we had thousands and thousands of individual Wisconsin residents speaking up in favor of the project, urging it to move forward, we have a handful of folks on the other side working with American Stewards of Liberty to try and create a sort of smokescreen of a fake legal idea to try and sabotage it.
Have there been courts that have upheld this coordination idea, or has it been universally rejected?
At least here in Wisconsin, it has been universally rejected. This came up during the Walker era, 2009, 2010. A number of Wisconsin towns tried to use this idea of coordination to say that they didn't have to do comprehensive land use planning. Even Scott Walker's attorney general wrote a lengthy legal opinion saying, essentially, this is made up. It's mumbo jumbo and it doesn't exist.
Were you aware that the opposition was being funded by this Texas-based Stewards of American Liberty?
We were not. As we were really working with supporters of the Pelican River Forest and helping folks organize to pass local resolutions to support the project or to get the word out, you know, we understood that there were a handful of county board members who were opposed to the project. State Senator Mary Felskowski had been outspoken in her opposition to the project. We then learned later on that our congressperson, Tom Tiffany, was involved, but it really wasn't until kind of the 11th hour that it turned up in some meeting minutes in a forestry committee up in Forest County that Congressman Tiffany had introduced some county board folks to the American Stewards of Liberty. Yeah, and to be clear, I'm not entirely sure about what the financial relationships are, what the ongoing relationship is. I know a number of local concerned citizens have filed, you know, records requests trying to dig to the bottom of this. You know, but it's certainly concerning to have a group from Texas coming here and telling us what Wisconsin residents should do with their own private land.
All right, we've been speaking with Gathering Waters Director of Strategic Initiatives, Charles Carlin. Thanks so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And now on this edition of Wildlife Weekly, feature contributor Jackie Sandberg takes a closer look at eastern gray squirrels and shares a recent success story at the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I want to talk about the eastern gray squirrels because we are sure getting babies in already. It is springtime, absolutely, even though it seems like it's cold and wet and raining, there are still babies being born, believe it or not. We actually have three different species of tree squirrels here in Wisconsin. We have the eastern gray squirrel, the fox squirrel, and the red squirrel, but the eastern gray squirrel is definitely the most common squirrel that we have in our area, especially around Madison or in Dane County, and we have babies being born at two different times of the year. So our mother squirrels have usually about 2 to 4 babies in a litter, but we have seen up to 6 or sometimes even more. And our first babies are born in about March or April, and then they do a second litter in about July or August. So they are being squirrely in the January and February time period, which is when they are finding their pairings, their mates, and they are building nests. And that's where we have our gestation period for squirrels while they're developing in the mom. And the reason I wanted to talk about it today was because we released a pregnant gray squirrel here in the last couple of weeks. Very, very exciting. It was an adult squirrel that came in injured and had some neurological problems that looked like a head tilt, maybe from falling or physical trauma. But she was able to successfully recover. And of course, lo and behold, on a day where we were examining her, we were like, ooh, her belly's kind of big. We were able to confirm that, yes, she did have tiny itty bitties in the womb. It was very exciting. And we did get the chance to release her just before her babies were born, knowing that we had a very specific timing to make sure that she was able to get out successfully. The great news is that we did have some very dedicated finders who knew the squirrel in their backyard. She had this beautiful kind of reddish, blondish coloration, so you could definitely tell which squirrel she was compared to some of the others. They do have quite a bit of different variation in their color patterns. Eastern gray squirrels are not just gray. They can be kind of reddish, kind of blondish, and we also see the black squirrels, which are still eastern gray squirrels. So this squirrel was given a nest box, which usually are kind of wooden constructions with holes in them made by volunteers, or sometimes our scout groups will definitely make some for us. And those boxes are hung in locations where those animals are found, either so that they have a home to go to, or if they didn't have a home previously, like a young squirrel, then we're giving them a new home to go wherever they're released. So it's a nice safe space for that squirrel to be able to live, reproduce, have protection, because as you probably know, squirrels do like to nest in people's homes, houses, garages, attics, and so having a nest box is an alternative site for them to use that might be a little bit more appropriate because you can hang it in a tree. Otherwise, they'd be building a dray, which is kind of their what we call paper nest, but it's made of sticks and twigs and leaves. And those aren't really as stable as something like a nice wooden squirrel box is. Definitely check out online if you want to research squirrel box. You can see there are patterns that you can make if you want to build any yourselves. And by all means, we'll always take those as donations if you're looking for a fun project with the kids. So the squirrel, who is pregnant, was released back in her home territory and was put in her nest box that she had while she was in treatment and rehabilitation at DCHS Wildlife Center. And the squirrel box has been in use ever since. The finder sent us some really great photographs of the mom squirrel using the box and has since had her babies as far as we know. And we know that maybe she'll even get to use that box again for her second litter this summer. So it was a really awesome story. It's one of our code of ethics to know that those animals are able to go back out into the population to reproduce and hopefully act like a normal squirrel. And she's doing great for all we know in all accounts, and they've gotten photographs and other things, and they continue to monitor her. So that monitoring process is amazing. We are very grateful to all the members of the public that bring us animals, and if we are able to release them back where they came from, keeping an eye out to see if it's successful. It's really, really just a very positive and heartwarming process. So you may be seeing squirrels at this time of year, knowing that babies are arriving. Just know that you should be looking around the bases of trees in case those squirrel nests, which you can kind of see pretty clearly right now before the leaves get really full in the trees. If there's a high wind, kind of, you know, any sort of temperature difference that could cause wind patterns to change where you get a really strong wind, or maybe it's just a short thunderstorm or something that would create a problem for a paper nest or that dray to be knocked down, or the babies maybe get jostled. Those speeds can really make or break whether or not nest is usable for a squirrel. So look at the base of the trees for any squirrels if you have them in your yard. If you see any of the babies fall down to the ground, you can definitely give us a call for advice on what to do next. Typically, squirrels are able to carry their babies back up the trees that they fall from if they are in those drays. So we've got some advice and tips and tricks on our website at www.giveshelter.org on how to reunite them safely with their parents. Otherwise, if they're injured from a fall, or they seem like they've got some sort of sickness, or they are truly orphaned from their parents, then we certainly recommend looking for your closest rehabilitator that works with our infant squirrels. Thanks for those that keep an eye on their squirrels, help their squirrels in their backyard, and know where to bring them for rehabilitation if you ever need the assistance. So this has been a segment here on WORT talking about eastern gray squirrels and a successful release of an adult female that had babies, and just a PSA that yes, baby squirrels are being born right now, and we should be on the lookout for them if they need help. So give us a call if you ever are not sure, or you want to send a photo, or you know are worried about any of the squirrels in your yard. Our number is 608-287-3235. Thanks for listening. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show tonight. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6.
Special thanks to feature contributors Jackie Sandberg, Her Turn's Joanne Powers, Brian Standing of the 8 o'clock Buzz, and Mike Moen of Wisconsin News Connection.
Super Deity Dave Lorenzen engineered tonight's show. Faye Parks produced this newscast. Host John K. Wilson also wrote your headlines this evening.
And host Sholly Pittman is the news director at WORT. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Up next is Spanish Language News Show in Nuestro Patio. Stay warm out there, stay safe, and go vote.